One of the shortcomings of the modern era is that we take so much for granted, and especially in terms of knowledge and industry and technology, where we are, if you will, as a modern age. For instance, we take personal computers for granted now because they are so ubiquitous. They're just everywhere. They're in not only the computers, obviously, we have, but we have multiple computers now, don't we? We have tablets, we have desktops, we have laptops, we have cell phones that are essentially the same thing. But computers are in our cars, they're in our appliances, they're in virtually everything, to the point where now all manner of tech people are talking about the Internet of all things, where everything is connected together, all of these devices. What's interesting to remember is that this personal computer revolution didn't start really getting a foothold until the early 1990s. I still remember my first computer. I have more storage on an SD drive than I had in that old computer. You know, it's just interesting and remarkable how far we've come. But that's not the only thing we take for granted. We take for granted even things in the realm of natural science. The knowledge that we have now of how large and amazing the universe is around us didn't really start to become a thing, if you will, until the early part of the 1900s. For thousands of years, mankind believed that Earth was the center of the universe and that the sun and stars orbited the Earth. When telescopes were developed and the planets became to be discovered, before that, they thought they were simply wandering stars, from the Greek word planeo, is where we get our word planets. These were stars from their observation that didn't stay fixed in the sky. They seemed to move about and wander. But as they began to discover these things, it became a very complicated thing in terms of math to maintain this model, because the orbits, as they saw them from Earth, didn't remain consistent, and it became very problematic, as I said. And then on top of that, they started discovering stars and nebulae that they realized were outside of our universe. Telescopes had advanced to the point of being able to peer very, very deep into space, and this presented another problem. The problem was, how far away were they? They understood they were outside of our local galaxy. Sorry, I said universe earlier, but they didn't know how far. After all, how can you measure that? You can't travel there and take a tape measure and figure out how far away it is. And so new math had to be invented. Non-Euclidean mathematics, or non-Euclidean geometry. What is non-Euclidean mathematics? Well, it's mathematics that is simply not Euclidean math. Euclidean math is flat surface math. So if I wanted to measure this room's floor space, I can do that with regular Euclidean math. But how do you measure space on a globe? How do you measure space that's not flat and space that you can't physically measure? That's where non-Euclidean math came in. It began to give them an idea of how vast the universe was. And one of the first questions these astrophysicists asked in the mid-1900s then was how big? Not only how far away these things are, but how big is the universe? How do you measure something, again, you can't physically travel to? So a number of scientists began to study this, and there were several that contributed to answering this question. Some of the more notable was Henrietta Swan Leavitt, Edward Hubble, who the space telescope is named after, and then later Albert Einstein with his theory of relativity that's still being proved out. They're the most notable, and one of the things that Hubble contributed was this ability to look at what's called the redshift in the light that comes from these various galaxies so far off, and as it fades, to be able to determine a measurement from that and understand how far away these things are. The more we probe the depths of Earth with devices like the Hubble telescope, the more we're intrigued by it. At one point in the Hubble telescope, I don't know if you know this, but you'd have to buy time, just like any other observatory. And so one time, I forget who it was that bought some time, there was this dark corner of the universe. They wanted to see if anything was there. So they point the telescope, they open the shutter, and they leave it there for like a week. And then they close the shutter and they want to see what's there. Many scientists expected it was just an empty spot. But when they looked at what was there, they found thousands and thousands and thousands of new galaxies they never even saw because they couldn't from Earth. Of course, we can see this incomprehensibly large universe as proof that God exists. But there are many that see exactly the opposite, that God does not exist because it is so huge, because it is so vast, that in spite of the time and the money spent searching for any life anywhere in the universe, they don't find it. The only life known to exist is on this little blue ball, this third rock from the sun we call Earth. And part of the reason why this planet is successful in having life is that it's what many scientists refer to as being fine-tuned. That if we were just a little closer or farther away from the sun, we couldn't support life on this planet the way it is. And there are many other examples to that. But as mankind's knowledge has grown, it's interesting to note, not in a good way, that respect and deference to God has equally waned. Can we prove God exists? One of the challenges increasingly for anyone in this day and age is to come to terms with God's existence. This is because academia and science is predisposed to ignore evidence of God's existence. In fact, they actively and enthusiastically promote evolution to the point that if it's challenged, that person is silenced. This scientific method has reigned in academia for multiple decades, and because they have successfully preached along with it the lie of evolution, very few young adults and even older adults make it through college with a religious mindset intact. This then spills into the rest of the culture to the point that religion as a whole is in decline. Certainly Christianity is as well, and that is reflected in attendance and belief. Today, then, let's consider this question. Is God real to you? Is God real to you? Because without seeing God as real, then his calling and his plan of salvation cannot be real either. You can and should see God as real in your life. Let's begin in Romans chapter 1. Is there proof in the creation? Many will point to that, and we have Romans 1 discussing this point where Paul challenges them to look at the natural world and consider God. In Romans 1 and verse 20, he says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made." That is, if I can put it in a little more vernacular, that we should be able to look at the natural world around us, all of it, every aspect of it, and see God's hand in it. I'll come back to that thought a little bit later here. But continuing here in Romans 1:20, he says, "Even his external, eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God," and especially as you look at this country, the history we have in terms of having the Bible and having God's blessings from the promises to Abraham, we should know God more than any other nation on the face of the earth at this time. But it says they did not glorify him as God. And look how we have walked away from God in just the last two decades. Nor were thankful. And I think that's one of the greatest sins of the modern era, is thanklessness. We have so much, and yet we complain at how awful life is. But it became futile in their thoughts, that is God's way of life, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Is there evidence in the natural world? Is there proof that God exists? Well, it's problematic. There's not direct proof, but as Paul writes, there's a great deal of evidence, isn't there? This fine-tuning of life, the fact that we have life, is really counterintuitive to science. You can look at a small creature like a bumblebee, and I'm sure you've probably heard this at some point, that little bumblebee shouldn't know how to fly. The wing-to-body weight size ratio is all wrong from normal science if you look at it that way. But as the story goes, the bumblebee doesn't know that, so he just flies anyway. But there are reasons even in that why he can fly, which just shows how astounding that creation is. Does the natural world prove the existence of God? No, there's evidence there, but it doesn't prove it. And I'm not parsing words here. I'm simply saying that for every thing that we would postulate as proof, others might show as proof for evolution. But let's ask that question. Does disproving evolution prove the existence of God? No, it doesn't directly. And there are many in the what's called the intelligent design community who see the flaws and shortcomings of evolution answering the questions of life and how it came to be and how the diversity came to be that aren't religious. They can't pull the trigger, if you will, to say God created this, but they do see design behind it. They see the flaws, as I said, but they're not willing to take that next step. Let's continue here in Romans 1, this time in verse 22. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of God into incorruptible, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man. That is, for most people in the world, even outside of this nation, outside of Christianity, they tend to make God in their image, don't they? And so even if you look back to the Greek and the Roman gods, they had the same flaws and shortcomings, the same emotional issues, if you will, that humans had. There really weren't gods in many respects. But this is the way man does things. We replace God with lesser copies, if you will, and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things, and therefore God gave them up to uncleanness. And so we get to a point that the more and more that God is removed from the culture and the world around us, it seems that man becomes more and more evil. It says, the lusts of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, to the point that we value the natural world around us more than human life. And this creates its own set of problems, doesn't it? Does removing ourselves as a culture, as a nation, as a world from God bring a better life or more problems? It's axiomatic that the more wealth we have, it seems, the more problems we have because we remove ourselves from God. Let's go to Psalm 53 next. The psalmist asked this question, or made this statement, I should say, in a slightly different way. And it sounds very condemning to say it this way. But in Psalm 53 in verse 1, it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Why is he a fool? Because the fool is not looking at evidence. The fool is not looking at the outcome. The fool has simply decided, if I say it is, then it is so. But that doesn't work in life, does it? I have an issue with heights. And it's an interesting issue. If I'm up secure inside something, a tall building, an airplane, I don't have a problem. If I'm on the edge of something high up, I have a problem. Stomach gets very wiggly. I don't like that. But if I said, and I wasn't careful, well, gravity's not going to affect me up here, that's foolishness, isn't it? Gravity is not dependent upon whether I believe in it or not. And whether a fool believes in God or not does not negate that he is. And so to finish the thought here in Psalm 53, verse 1, it says, they are corrupt, and they have done abominable iniquity, and there are none who do good. And so this is the state of man. To the point that if we read Matthew 24, we find that Christ said that he has to return so mankind doesn't destroy all life. This is how corrupt and how abominable mankind is going to become. The complexities of life are astounding, and the more we look into how life works, the more complexity we see, even down to a molecular level. Every conclusion, though, requires a foundational premise, doesn't it? If I'm going to make a decision, I have to start somewhere. I have to start with a premise. But there are only two premises to consider in answering this question, does God exist? Is he real to us? The first is, either God created everything that exists, and he has established the standard of a behavior for this life, like a manufacturer that sends out a booklet, tells you how to use the product. They built it. They know how it works. Either God created everything and established those standards, or two, he doesn't exist. It's just those two premises. If that's the case, then life is a result of random chance. We're free to live our life any way we want. There are no morals. There are no boundaries. There is no right and wrong. And that sounds awful to our ears. But look at where we've come again just in the last 20 years. What was not acceptable in so many areas of life is now not only acceptable, but promoted and expected to be accepted. Let's look at Hebrews 11:3. In considering this, we're leading up to some answers, but we have premises again we're considering. And one thing that's not considered in the world around us is that much like mankind in the early part of the 1900s, not understanding that there was a vast universe outside of our galaxy, they don't understand that outside of the physical realm, there are other forces, if you will, at play. In Hebrews 11 and verse 3, it says, "By faith we understand the worlds were framed by the word of God." What is that faith? Well, that faith is Genesis 1, isn't it? God spoke and it existed. We weren't there. We'll come back to this much later in the sermon, but that was the comments and the statements that God made to Job, wasn't it? Where were you when I laid the foundations? How do you know how this works when the animals know when to migrate and when to reproduce, and how does the rain cycle work and all these things? There is faith in this, isn't there? And it's not just blind faith, but continuing here, that through faith, we understand the worlds were framed by the word of God so that the things which are seen were not made of the things which are visible. This is one of the great questions and the great problems that evolution can't address. Even if, as they look back into space, and the current, I think it was just launched this past week, space telescope that went up is now called the James Webb Telescope, Deep Space. And what they're saying with it is, it's an interesting statement, they are going to be able to peer back to the point of, they won't use the word creation, but to the very beginning at the Big Bang. Because they're going to be able to see light in a way that the Hubble has not, and to view it in deeper, further distances than Hubble ever could. But what they're not considering is how it came to be. Even if you consider it all back to a singular point, and I don't agree with the Big Bang as it's postulated, but you have to admit, they have to admit, at one point there was nothing, and now there's something. What happened? The things that we are seeing, that we see, are not made of things which are visible. Something else brought it into existence. So what is God? In considering this question, we have to consider what he is. And let's go to John 4. The first problem we encounter in answering this question is that God cannot be defined empirically. That is, we can't measure him, we can't feel him, we can't hear him directly, we can't see him. The physical things that we would use to quantify something, we don't have. And there's a reason for that. In John 4 and in verse 24, we have the statement here from Christ that God is spirit, not physical. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth. That word truth is interesting. We'll come back to that a little bit later as well. Truth is not negotiable, is it? It's not flexible. It's not changeable. It's either truth or it's not truth. And so we have to understand what God is. He is not only spirit, but he is truth. Spirit can't be measured, though, can it, as I said? For the most of mankind, since that's the case, then they leap to the conclusion that then God must not exist. If I can't measure him, if I can't empirically determine he exists, then he must not exist. But there's a huge flaw in that line of reasoning. For thousands of years, mankind couldn't see the expanse of the universe, could they? They thought this earth was the center of everything. They could see the sun, they could see the moon, they could see the fixed stars and these wandering stars, and in their minds, that's all that existed. Well, considering that God doesn't exist because I can't feel him is really no different. The planets I mentioned as earlier were these wandering stars. And it was very complicated math to calculate those orbits. But it worked in that closed environment for a time. You'd have some outliers like comets. They couldn't explain comets. And so comets were, for many, the harbingers of bad news. Usually bad omens. Something terrible was going to happen if you saw a comet. And then, of course, you'd have eclipses and things of this nature, heavenly signs that in many cases either people would freak out over, or again, they would determine was some omen from the gods. But that's not the only thing that can't be measured, the galaxy and the universe around us. We have all manner of things that as humans we take at face value, that we can't measure, we can't quantify, that there is, if you will, an element of faith involved in them. For instance, can we measure love? We can see aspects of it, can't we? We can see a parent loving a child, taking care of an infant. We can see someone give a gift for someone on a special date. We can look at it and see it and know what it is. But is one type of love better than another? Sometimes, in some cases, but again, how do you quantify it? At what level is love real to a person? You have attraction, you can have infatuation, but is that love? Is it only love at a certain point, once it goes past a certain stage? Can we measure enthusiasm? There's some people that show any enthusiasm, don't they? You wonder if they're alive sometimes. They're just kind of there. And you think they're angry at the world or something, but they just don't show enthusiasm. But when you see what they do in their lives, you can see enthusiasm and the things that they commit their time to and the passions that they have. We can see, again, enthusiasm expressed on different levels, but is there only one true form of enthusiasm? Is it not enthusiasm if it's more internal? Some would argue that we can't even really measure intelligence. A college degree might be one metric, but I know some really stupid college graduates, and I know some really smart people who've never been to college, and I know the opposite as well. My grandfather was one such individual where he only went through grade 8, and that was not unusual in the early 1900s. They were expected to help out on farms and whatnot. But he had a curious mind, and he developed over the course of his lifetime 3 patents. Very smart man. But what qualifies is intelligence. Is it book knowledge? Is it life knowledge? Is it insight? Wisdom? Creativity? What is intelligence? Can we measure pain? This is one that's come forward more and more in our modern culture because we can have pain from so many different things. Physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain. But how do you quantify pain? We could go through the exact same trauma, maybe a car accident. We're both beaten up pretty bad. One person may not feel much trauma after a couple of days, and the other person may then, for the rest of their life, have something that contributes to pain. Is pain not real if it can't be quantified? Unfortunately, there are some doctors that have that view. It must be in your head. Is pain not real if a doctor can't point to a damaged or injured part of the body? Here's another one. What part of the brain accounts for language? This is another problem for evolution. Certainly there are parts of the brain that light up, if you will, when they do scans and they can see what area of the brain processes language. But what process in the brain makes this possible? Is it a chemical reaction? For years, there were many in the evolution community that thought language came from brain size. But then they began to realize there are some animals with much bigger brains that can't begin to communicate the way we do. So they had to set that aside. Then some now say, well, maybe there's something physical in the makeup of the brain, the way it's assembled, if you will, the parts that touch each other. But they still can't come to an agreement because they're not looking in the right place. But again, none of these things can be quantified, but nobody doubts them. So let's go to 1 Corinthians 2 next. The one question overriding that evolution cannot answer is why is mankind different from the rest of the animals? And there are some that will argue we're not. That these processes, these emotions, these things that humans can do are simply because of various things down the evolutionary trail. But that doesn't answer it. Because if evolution truly favored these sort of things in terms of survival, then why wouldn't more creatures have them? 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 11, Paul writes this, "For what man knows the thing of a man except the spirit of man that is in him?" This is the component that flummoxes the evolutionists because, again, you can't measure spirit, can you? And yet, from the beginning, again, Genesis 1, God gave man part of his spirit to be able to think like him, reason like him, have emotions, to be able to create, to be able to think like we think, to ponder and to consider. All of these things are because mankind has a spirit in him, which is why we can think and behave the way we do. Even so, the verse continues, no one knows the things of God except, and I would insert the word by, except by the Spirit of God. God's way of life is spiritually discerned, isn't it? We go through that repeatedly, in the Holy Days especially. That's why I don't try to argue with anybody that wants to argue doctrine with them. I tell them, I have better things to do, because I'm not going to convince them without God's Spirit. It's just a pointless argument. The Spirit of man is there because we're to reflect the image of God now, but especially so in the life to come. And so in that Spirit, we have something else that mankind can't determine. And this is a very interesting topic. Don't necessarily recommend it. But if you have a free day and you want to go down a rabbit hole on the internet, search free will. Because science can't come to any conclusion on this. But free will is necessary, isn't it, to become like God? Because free will means we have choice. We choose whether we want to sin or whether we want to strive to be righteous. We choose whether we want to obey God or reject him. We make choices all the time. This is another example of something that can't be measured. But you'll see, hopefully you can see that on the screen, one of the quotes I found that was very interesting was from a man named Michael Egnor. He's a neurosurgeon, somebody that studies brains. This is a conclusion that he came to. He says, denial of free will logically denies the capacity to make any truth claim at all. Because truth understands you have choice, right? Meaning you have to understand what's out there to choose from. If there is no free will, then there is no choice. And there are some that go down that line. Those are called materialists. The materialists say, I'm not responsible because I don't have free choice. This is simply a result of whatever chemical processes in my brain, influences from the world around me, or whatever it may be. I'm not accountable. That's problematic, though, isn't it? Free will is a better place to be in my mind because it shows that God wants to work with us, reason with us, that we have the capacity to learn. Because without free will, then there really isn't the ability to learn anything. And so what is the first step in proving the existence of God? Put the word proving in quotes. To make him real in your mind, what's one of the first steps? Let's go to Hebrews 11. We have this component of faith that we've already touched on. And Hebrews 11 is going to expand on that a bit. This whole chapter is called the faith chapter, and there are examples of individuals in the Old Testament and the faith that they had in the lives that they lived with God's calling. But in Hebrews 11, verse 6, it says, but without faith is impossible to please him. In order to please somebody, you have to know they exist, don't they? You have to value them. He says, to continue, for he who comes to God must believe that he is. And again, this is counterintuitive to everything that's taught in academia and science. The first step in science is to measure it, to quantify it. But if we can't quantify spirit, then how do we determine if it is? Well, belief. We have to accept that it's there. And we do this all the time in science. Black holes, for a long time, were not believed to exist. They were theorized by men like Stephen Hawking and others who saw things in the universe that didn't make sense. Something was affecting the way matter moved, the way galaxies moved, the way light moved, and they came to finally understand it had to be something they couldn't see. They ran the math. They figured these things existed. But the really curious thing, that it wasn't until a couple of years ago that they actually saw a black hole. And it made news. It was the first time ever they proved they existed. Why is religion any different? Why is belief in God any different? To accept a premise, I don't understand, but this seems to be all the evidence pointing to this. And what happens if I move forward on this? And I believe that's the major reason why most people are stuck. Because if I prove it's possible, what do I have to do with it? I have to follow it. Because if I reject it, now I'm rejecting a truth. And that has consequences. Let's finish verse 6 here. Not only is faith necessary to please God and that we must believe that he is, notice what happens here. This is not blind, empty faith. It's one-sided. That God is also a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. That is, as we pursue understanding God, he reveals more of himself to us. This verse is oftentimes called the first article of faith. And as I alluded to, faith is uncomfortable in an empirical world. But God does promise to reward us if we diligently seek him. And so we come to what we used to talk about decades ago in the church as the seven proofs of God's existence. These are things that we could look to. These are things that we can bring up to those questioning whether God exists or not. But it still requires intelligence, doesn't it? A belief in faith. The first one up there is lawgiver. What do I mean by lawgiver? Well, there are laws throughout the universe. And the really curious thing is that if evolution is true, why are the laws of physics consistent throughout the whole universe? Otherwise, you couldn't determine things like black holes. You couldn't measure redshift. You couldn't do any of these things because what if your math is completely different from the reality of that part of the universe? But yet it does react the same way. Chemicals behave the same way everywhere. All of these things are consistent. There has to be a law governing that. And so we see law in the universe. Evolution doesn't follow law. It's random chance. It's selection based on other criteria. Second point is that creation demands a creator. And that's followed up by the next point we'll cover in a second here. But the universe had a beginning, as I mentioned earlier. At one point, there was nothing. Physical, nothing existed, and then everything existed. Something changed all that, which means there has to be a creator behind it. You follow that up with the fact that we have radioactive material in the universe, and if it always existed, we wouldn't have radioactive material. It would have all decayed radioactively to lead. The next point follows up on this, and that is biogenesis. And the law of biogenesis is simply that life comes from life. This is the Achilles heel of evolution because they can take certain amino acids, they can put them in a flask, they can have a closed system, they can massage those elements and create, building blocks from which they can create amino acids, but they don't know what to do with it beyond that. It's not true life. It's simply a chain of these amino acids, these proteins and whatnot. How does all that work? Where did life come from? The next one is supreme intelligence, and that is this design aspect of intelligence. What this is referring to is that you see in all of this some intelligence, and what I mean by that is some of you are probably familiar with this. I don't know if it's still in the science books, but when I went through high school, you'd have these charts in one of your biology probably textbooks, and they would call it probably comparative embryology. So if you look at the little fetuses of various animals, in their very early stages, they all look very similar. And so evolutionists would say, well, that's evidence we all came from a common ancestor, and it's only as those fetuses, embryos develop that you begin to have these distinctions. Well, that's one way of looking at it. And I always remembered the statement that Alicia made going through her biology classes that she mentioned to me, in when she was being pushed hard on evolution. She said, made the comment. She said, I realized that almost every argument made for evolution could be used to prove God. Depends on the perspective you're coming from. And the fact that all those little fetal developments look similar only show intelligence of where things need to start. And you follow that up then with the next one, which is design demands a designer. We see this in the created world all around us. This is, I think, part of what Paul was even referring to in Romans 1. How many of you are familiar with what's called the golden ratio? Few. I think more of you know what it is than know what the name is. this is that spiral that shows what's called the, well, in the golden ratio, what we consider beautiful, but it also speaks to design in that it is repeated extensively throughout the creation. So you'll see it, for instance, in the shape of an ear. If you put that golden ratio to your ear, it lines up. Spiral galaxies look the same. The spacing of the little nubs on pineapples, that spiral follows the golden ratio. All of these things that are in the created world, that shows a designer. It's not random chance. If it was random chance, it'd be all over the place. The next two become more problematic for people outside of believing in a God, and that is fulfilled prophecy. But it is a proof. We see in history, not just in Scripture, we see in history fulfillment of these things. One of the most notable is the vision Daniel was given of these four beasts. And we can see in history how that has played out. And it's not just the Church of God. More and more, even in the Christian communities, have accepted this. But then we have a really interesting one as number seven, and that is answered prayer. Answered prayer is one that's quickly dismissed, but it is becoming problematic for those in the evolution community, especially those that want to reject God, because there are interesting studies that have been done in the last number of decades, blind studies that show that if someone's in the hospital, they're dealing with some major illness or whatever, that if there's a group of people praying for them, they tend to do better in their recovery. The really interesting thing is that even if the person doesn't know they're being prayed for, they tend to recover better than someone who is not prayed for. And that's just one example. I would hope that those of you that are older that have witnessed this in your life would share those stories, especially with those that are younger, to know that God will act in your life is an amazing thing to have happen. So what is our responsibility now? Well, in answering that question, let's go next to 1 John 4 and verse 8. We have to, in considering is God real, know who he is and know what we need to do with that. So in 1 John 4 and verse 8, we read here, "He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." So it's not love as we would define it, not love as the culture would define it, not love that is fluid. It has to be love based in truth. It has to be love that reflects God, because God at his core is love. How do we show that love then to him and to each other? Well, let's go next to Galatians chapter 5. That love has to be acted upon as God would act on it. One of the questions that critics will put to a Christian is, if there is a loving God, then why does he allow, and fill in the blank, why does he allow such evil in the world? Why does he allow such suffering in the world? Why does he allow, and this is the famous one, oh, now that I want to say his name, it escapes me, a British actor, atheist, that said, why would God allow little children to die of cancer? How do you answer that question? Well, you answer the question by explaining what God's love looks like. That it's not that it's not love, it's that he's working out a process, isn't he? We just rehearsed much of that a couple of weeks ago. But in Galatians 5 and verse 13, Paul says, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty." There is liberty in God's way of life. But as he says here, do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh. The aspects of liberty is not to be selfish, not to do what we want to hurt others, not to be free to do whatever we choose to do, no matter what the consequences are. It says here, but rather through love, serve one another. So we're to take that love that God is in 1 John 4:8, and we're to serve with it. And there's an interesting thing that happens when we do that then. We begin to see God more because we're emulating him. Have you ever spent time with someone you didn't know and you begin to see more of who they are, what they value, the more time you spend with them? It's just a natural thing, isn't it? The more we spend time with God, the more we see him, the more we understand who he is. And so David even pondered this question in Psalm 8:4. And I have to wonder, a picture in my mind, David as a shepherd, and at night especially, there's not a whole lot to do. The animals are mostly sleeping, but you have to watch out for predators. You have to make sure you don't have the odd one wandering off and getting into trouble somewhere. But for the most part, you can sit and think about a lot of things. And there's no city lights, no light pollution. So he looks up at the night sky and you see hundreds of thousands, if not millions of stars. And you begin to ponder the existence. And he asks that question, what is man that you are mindful of him? That mankind does not understand that God created all this with a purpose. That we are created with a purpose. And that there's so much that mankind doesn't see right now, but that he's ultimately desiring to bring them into his family. And let's look at that in Malachi chapter 2. There's so many of these truths that spill into so many different areas of our lives. And when we discount God, we remove from ourselves the opportunity to understand things. Malachi 2 and verse 15, one of the things that God was taking Israel to task through Malachi here was the fact that they had drifted in their respect for the institution of marriage. And so he addresses a point here, Malachi 2 verse 15, but did he not make them one? And again, going back to Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, he took those two created beings, human beings, a man and a woman, he created a family, didn't he? He made them one, two people together being one. And he says, having a remnant of the Spirit, his Spirit, meaning a portion. We touched on that earlier. But he asks the question, why one? The answer is, he seeks godly seed. Now, godly seed can be talked about on multiple levels. We had the blessing of little children today here. So we have godly seed that he wants raised in a family. That part of our responsibilities as parents is to raise children in a godly fashion, meaning pointing them to God, teaching them the value of God's way of life, and helping them to live in it. That's one aspect. The other aspect is that we become his godly seed. That as we take on his nature, learn to be like him, we become like him, we are his children. Even now, this is what he desires. And so he says, therefore, take heed to your spirit. Be careful with it. It's all about family. You and I have been called in various ways. Some of us through parents, grandparents, maybe extended family members, maybe friends, maybe in some other way. No matter how we're called, we are now family, aren't we? In a normal course of life, if I had never been a part of the Church of God, I wouldn't know any of you. Because I wouldn't be in Wisconsin. I'd be somewhere else because I grew up in Ohio. Who knows where I would be? But we're family, aren't we? Many of us, I would hope most of us, have a bond that even supersedes any physical family we have. Because we have a purpose and a unity in this family that we don't have in our physical families for the most part. But God has given us everything, hasn't he? And this is the component of proving God. That's an interesting thought to consider. This whole aspect of does God exist comes down to whether we can prove him. That's the question I ask. Can we prove God exists? Well, in order to prove him, we have to be part of the process, don't we? And that's an interesting thing to consider as well. I was trying to look for the verse that just came to mind here. Here it is. 2 Thessalonians 5, verse 21. It says, test all things. I like the King James better, the authorized version. It says, prove all things. Now, in the context of the ancient world, to prove or to test something means you tried it out. We do this in a modern era. Well, most people do, I suspect. If you buy some major appliance or a car or whatever, you want to see it run. Does it work? How easy is it to function? But there's another component to this in terms of proving. We want to know that it's real, right? God is the same way. He's not an unprovable God that we can test him. But the catch, if you will, is the second part, isn't it? Once we test it, then we hold fast to what's good. And this is the problem that many run into, humanly speaking. They might begin to see God as important, that he is real, that he exists in the universe, but they don't want to follow the instruction. And that becomes the question for each of us then, isn't it, in our calling? Will I listen to God as I prove him? Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Get back on my notes here. 1 Corinthians 2. And verse 14. The natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, as I mentioned earlier. I could not go out on the street, if you will, grab the first person that comes along and convince them the Sabbath is not only important, but it's vital for their salvation to understand, to move forward another truth. They're not going to understand anything I'm saying because they don't have God's Spirit at this point. And so consequently, as it says here, for they are foolishness to him. So if you try to explain any of these teachings that God has revealed in his word, that he's opened our minds to, it doesn't resonate because it seems foolishness. How can you tithe 20%, some years 30% of your income, and still be okay? I've had people tell me, I can't afford to tithe. My response is, you can't afford not to tithe. Because God blesses it, and it shows so many other things in life. But let's continue here. What man knows the things of a man except the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. We're back to John 4:24. God is spirit. So to know him, we have to have his spirit. And so it has to be spiritually discerned. And so if you are questioning whether God exists, whether God is real to you, ask God to reveal himself through his Spirit. That's not circular reasoning. It's simply asking him to show himself. And he says that he will do that. But let's consider now what we should do with all of this. Once we come to this point, let's go to 2 Peter chapter 3. We've looked at the natural world. We see evidence of design. We see evidence of intelligence. We see a creator. We see all of these things. We then put it into practice, and we begin to see the reality of it play out. We keep the Sabbath, and we see blessings come our way. We tithe. We see blessings come our way. We do the various things that God says to do. In Deuteronomy 28, he said, if you do these things, I will bless you in all these things, above and beyond what we're doing. So in 2 Peter 3 and verse 10, this is Peter saying, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. And it will come as a thief because people are focused and preoccupied with other things. They're not focused on God. So they're not going to be paying attention. It says, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, the elements will melt with fervent heat, both the earth and the works that are in them will be burned up. Since we know all this, he says, verse 11, therefore, since all these things will be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness? What should we do with it? And so he says, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which all these things will happen. We need to put it into practice. One of the saddest things I've heard young adults say in the Church of God is, I don't know that I want to be in the first resurrection. And if you ask the question, why, they say, I have too many things I want to experience in the world yet. Worst case scenario, I'll be in the second resurrection. And it's like, ooh, that's a real dangerous place to be. Because we're still judged on what we know, aren't we? If that's a thought you have, I would encourage you not to do that. Let's go to Matthew 7. What person ought we to be? Matthew 7 tells us that we should ask. I've had these conversations with young adults especially as well. As they come to considering baptism, it becomes a very real thing. I'm not condemning it. I'm not putting this sermon out there today to make it sound harder than it is. Simply that there is a process and that we have to be part of it. In Matthew 7 and verse 7, this is what Christ says here in terms of these things and others. Ask and it will be given to you. This is why we have to be very careful what we ask. I had a very good friend at Ambassador College years ago that later, as the church began to accept heresy, he mentioned to me one time that his prayer to God was to ask to understand this new truth. And I said, that's the wrong prayer. You know what happened? He understood the new truth. He's no longer in the church. Yeah, be careful what you ask for. But if you're asking for the right things, God says, I'll give it to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and it will be open to you. If you're asking God to have him show himself to be real in your life, there is no reason why he won't do that. And that's not just if you're a young adult. There are times I still ask him that. We need reassurance humanly, don't we? Because again, we are physical. We're looking for things we can quantify, and we can't always quantify things. So he goes on to say, for everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, to him who knocks it will be open. Or what man is there among you, if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Even humanly, we know what to do in these things. If he asks for a fish, will he give him a snake? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask of him? That's the key, isn't it? To ask for good things. When we ask for blessings, to ask for the blessings for the right reasons, that we can serve, that we can be edified, that we can be stronger in the faith in these things. To ask for the Powerball will just create a whole lot of problems. Verse 12, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do to them also. This is known as the golden rule, isn't it? To live as God would have us live, to bless others. Because God's way of life permeates the universe. You remember the quote about free will? If there is no free will, there is no truth. And truth is throughout God's creation. It permeates everything. There's a cause and effect on a spiritual level, if you will, for everything. And so those laws are very real and very alive. And they're much as a part of our life as any physical law of science is. And again, God has created all that to bring us into his family. Let's begin to conclude here. Last few verses. Let's go to Acts 2 next. When Peter gave his sermon on the day of Pentecost there, 31, he started out talking about Jesus Christ. They all knew about it. This is Jerusalem. This is probably the word on the street, the buzz going around the town was this crucifixion and all that had happened, transpired. And now they're at this day of Pentecost at the temple. And he begins to preach to them about what Christ had done, what he had fulfilled in the prophecies, how he was rejected and how they had killed him. And there were many individuals in this group that were part of that crowd before Pilate saying, kill him. I don't know, but I have to wonder. But it convicted them. They had two choices. They either consider if this was part of what they were a part of, or to say, you're ridiculous. I'm not going to listen to any of this. But in verse 37, it says, when they heard this, they were cut in their heart. It convicted them. They couldn't walk away from it. And so then they asked the right question next. That question is, what do we do? How do I make this better? How do I move forward? So he tells them to repent and be baptized and receive the Spirit of God. And we saw how that dramatically changed their lives and changed the world, didn't it? Whether you're still contemplating baptism or whether you've been baptized for 40 years or more, ask God to show you for him to make himself real in your life. Whatever that means, a job that is needed, a better environment that's needed, help and support in various trials, whatever. But the key is to seek God. And let's look at that in Matthew 6. Another problem of the modern age around us is that we have a world full of idols. And most people would not label them as such. But the simple definition of an idol is simply anything that stands before God that we worship more than him. It can be lifestyle, it can be money, it can be relationships, it can be all kinds of things. In Matthew 6 and verse 33, we're reminded here of where our focus should be, because he's telling his disciples in the crowds not to worry, that God takes care of the birds and the animals. He provides all that they need. He says, so you don't need to worry. Verse 32, he says, for after all these things the Gentiles seek. And look at what people pursue. They pursue things, don't they? The things don't last. They wear out, they get stolen, they break, whatever. After all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows what you need of all these things, verse 32, but seek first as a primary thing in life. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you. Seek God while he can be found. Seek his will in our life, and he will be real to us. If you want to take a deeper dive on this subject, I would recommend our United booklet, Does God Exist? It touches on most of these points in more depth than I have time to go through here today. But as we conclude, let's look lastly at Job 42. The story of Job is the story of this sermon, that Job thought he knew God, but he didn't really know God. He had certain expectations, certain thoughts of what he thought God was. And God leads him through this whole process, at times a very painful, literally painful process. But he wanted Job to understand how real he was and how much he wanted to be a part of Job's life if Job would truly let him be. So in Job 42, we're not going to read the whole account, just a few verses here, beginning in verse 2. Job then comes to this point after God questions him. After he tells Job's friends, you really don't know what you're talking about, we'll come back to that point. Job will have to offer some offerings for you. But he says to Job now, okay, where were you when I established the foundations? Where were you when I created these things? Can you explain how these animals function this way? All of these things, and Job had to realize how arrogant it sounded for him to say he knew anything. And so Job then says here, I know that you can do everything and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. There are times I look at the creation and I marvel at what God has created. How those animals know to migrate. And we see the sandhill cranes come in, the conservancy behind our house, and every year they know when to come, and every year they know when to leave. I can't do that without a calendar and a clock. And they just know how to do it, and they know where to find food, they know how to build their nests, they know all this stuff without any books. Job says, too wonderful for me. Listen, please, let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. I grew up as a young boy, hearing by the ear. I sat in church before I was even taking notes, and I would listen to the sermonettes and the sermons, and I heard all of that. But at some point, it had to be real to me. But now my eye sees you. We have to see God for him to be real in our lives. I pray that that is a reality in your life, that even if you can't prove empirically that God exists, that you know from everything else in your life that he is real, that you can see him real in your life and everything that you do and everything that he provides. May he always be real to each and every one of us.